Welcome to the All of Christ for All of Life podcast, brought to you by Canon Plus. This week's episode is a talk from Dr. Joe Rigney entitled, How to Fight Like a Narnian, from Grace Agenda 2023. Check out the full conference now at mycanonplus.com.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be with you here, and I'm excited for these three sessions that we have from Dr. Erb and Dr. Apple, and the theme that we've kind of oriented all three of these talks around is warfare, and so I've got Fight Like a Narnian. We'll get some swords later from Dr. Erb, and then Professor Apple will talk about feasting and fighting. So let me begin with a word of prayer, and then we'll dive straight in to this first talk. So, Lord, I pray for your help and grace as I seek to express and clearly show the value of war and how we should fight. There's a way to fight the war that we're in, the spiritual war, the cultural war that we're in, and we want to fight like Christians, which means we want to fight like Narnians. So grant us grace as we try to do so. In Jesus' name, amen. So we are in the midst of a spiritual war. You know from your Bible, our war is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers and authorities, principalities and powers in the heavenly places. So there's a war against demonic forces. Those demonic forces often enslave human beings, deceive them, and enlist them in the war. And so there are human enemies. There are people who are opposed to God, who are opposed to his church. And so they too are enemies, and we need to wage war against them. And then more fundamental to both of those is the war in your own heart, the dragon that you have to slay in your own heart. You have a war against sin, your own flesh. There's a war there. So the Christian life is a life of war. And one of the taglines you'll see around here at New St. Andrews is build and fight, right? Our bookstore is called Swords and Shovels. And that comes from the book of Nehemiah. If you remember, the Jews are rebuilding Jerusalem after the exile. They've been sent back. They've been commissioned to be able to rebuild this wall. And they encounter opposition from the peoples of the land. The peoples of the land don't want this city to be rebuilt. And so they're harassing them. They're trying to make trouble for them. And because of that, Nehemiah then says this in chapter 4. He says, from that day on, half of my servants worked on construction and half held the swords, the spears, the shields, the bows, and the coats of mail. And the leaders stood behind the whole house of Judah who were building on the wall. And those who carried burdens were loaded in such a way that each labored on the work with one hand and held his weapon with the other. So there it is, build and fight. They've got sword in one hand, shovels in the other, and they're building and they're fighting. And so, because of that, we're going to learn to fight. We need to learn to fight like Christians. The Lord has to train our hands for war, and one of the ways that God trains our hands for war is through good stories. One of the reasons we read good stories is to learn to fight well, and so that's why we're going to first draw here from the Narnian Chronicles. Now, everything I'm going to say here, I think, most of it, is in my little book, Live Like a Narnian. So if you are listening and you're taking notes and you're like, what did he say? That's fine. You can just go pick up the book and you'll get that and more. But I want to begin by talking about chivalry. Okay, who knows what chivalry is? Okay, chivalry is the ancient sort of medieval code that put demands on human nature. C.S. Lewis wrote an essay on chivalry one time in which he actually called chivalry the great hope of the world. Maybe he's been a little hyperbolic, but he saw chivalry, that medieval ideal, as a crucial element to recover because it was being lost in his day, and by ours, it's definitely been lost. And the reason is that chivalry makes a double demand on human nature. Okay, it makes a double demand, not just a singular demand, a double demand. Here's Lewis. The knight, okay, so the knight, that medieval knight is sort of the chivalric ideal. Think Knights of the Round Table, King Arthur, that sort of thing. The knight is a man of blood and iron, a man familiar with the sight of smashed faces and ragged stumps of lopped off limbs, okay? So that's a knight has to be able to fight. He's got to be able to go to war. He is also a demure, almost a maiden-like guest in hall, a gentle, modest, unobtrusive man, okay? So on the one hand, he's a man of blood and iron, and on the other hand, he's a gentle, modest, unobtrusive man. Okay, you see how those feel like they don't go together, okay? And Lewis, this is really important. He is not a compromise between ferocity and meekness. It's not like he says, okay, ferocity's over here, and meekness and humility's over here, and let's just split the difference and sort of be halfway ferocious and halfway meek. Instead, Lewis says, the knight is fierce to the nth and meek to the nth. He lives at both poles. That's the double demand. Knights are called to be ferocious and are called to be meek. And that combination of ferocity and meekness, restricted to the appropriate occasions. There's times and places, there's situations where you need ferocity, you need fierceness, and there's situations where you want meekness and modesty, is necessary because humanity is prone to fall into two errors, two types of groups. On the one hand, humanity's prone to become bloodthirsty wolves or cowardly lambs. Okay? Those are the two ditches that humanity tends to migrate to. And Lewis actually thinks that the history of the world is kind of almost a cyclical progression in which cruel barbarians sort of pillage and destroy a civilization. So there's that ferocity of the wolves. And then they kind of settle in and they become soft and they become decadent and they become weak and then they're unable to resist the next barbarians. Does that make sense? So you have barbarians and then they settle in, they get civilized, they get soft, and then new barbarians come and take their place. And chivalry was the way to break that cycle. Because chivalry said, no, we need to permanently have that intensity, that ferocity, that fierceness in order to defend things. But we also need to have that civilized, modest meekness. And so it breaks the cycle by creating lion-like lambs and lamb-like lions. That's the goal of chivalry. So here's Lewis again. The medieval ideal brought together two things which have no natural tendency to gravitate towards one another. These things don't naturally belong together. It brought them together for that very reason. It taught humility and patience to the great warrior because everyone knew by experience how much he usually needed that lesson. And it demanded valor and courage of the urbane and modest man because everyone knew that he was likely as not to be a milksop. He was likely to be like a wet paper towel. Okay, that's how firm he was. And so it said, hey, no, we're going to have an ideal that's going to combine those two in their fullness. Okay? And it covers a whole range of human existence, social situations, whether it's swords in battle or manners when meeting a woman for the first time. This is not something that just happens. Lewis says it's art, meaning it's something that has to be cultivated. It's a skill. It's an ability. It's not nature. It has to be taught, encouraged, and cultivated. And then Lewis decides, I'm going to put that in Narnia. Okay? I'm going to display that ideal in Narnia. And the best place to see it, I think, is in Prince Caspian in the character of High King Peter. And there's a lot of things we could talk about here, so I'm just going to flag a few. So first, if you remember in that story, Peter in battle is a picture of knightly shrewdness and bravery. Okay, so if you remember the story, when Peter shows up and the battle lines are drawn, he decides, hey, I need to buy myself some time. We don't want to get into just a knockdown drag out because I don't know if our army's strong enough to take it. So instead, he challenges Miraz to monomachy, man-to-man combat. Like, send out your champion, we'll send out our champion, and we'll see who wins. This is sort of David Goliath type challenge. And so he's going out there to fight a much bigger, stronger man. This is David and Goliath. But Peter draws first blood, and then he uses his youth and stamina to his own advantages. He knows, okay, what do I have that he doesn't have? What does he have that I don't have? He's got strength. If I just try to go smash into him like this, if I go toe-to-toe, he's going to beat me. But I'm quick and I'm younger, which means I can probably outlast him. I have more stamina. And so he would kind of dance around and try to draw it out in hopes that Miraz would wear down. He would get slower. He would get tired in order. So this is shrewdness. This is wisdom looking at, hey, we're going to be in the middle of a fight. And if I'm going to fight, I want to use the advantages that I have well. And he does this. I think one of the more telling aspects of this is he's trying to wear him down in the hot sun. And meanwhile, when he does it, Miraz's army, the Telmarines who are surrounding it, do you remember what they did whenever he's just kind of dancing around? They start calling him a coward. Coward, come on, fight. Don't dance, fight. They start calling him a coward. Now, If he was just a wolf, if he didn't have self-control, he would have taken the bait. Oh, they're calling me a coward. I'll show them. And he would have run in there to try to fight, you know, heavy and probably gotten beat. And so instead, he has to resist the taunts. He has to care. I don't care if they're going to call me names. I don't care if they're going to call me a coward. This is the right strategy. And he persists in the strategy despite the name calling. Okay? You begin to think of applications for that. You need to not care what they call you. Okay? Don't be a coward, but don't care if they call you one. Okay? Be wise, be smart, be shrewd. Okay, so if Peter resists he shows composure under those taunts. He's knocked down right at one point, and it looks like, oh no, he's about to get beat, but he actually uses Miraz's arm as a ladder to kind of climb back up. So when Miraz kind of stabs, he grabs him, pulls him down, and switches places. So again, he knows how to use his body. And then when he gets injured, he never loses his composure. He doesn't show fear, but he comes over, he's like, hey, this may be it. And he comes over and he tells Edmund, give everyone my love if I die, right? So he's like, he's thinking about other people, even as he might die. Tell everybody else that I love them. And then finally, there's this key moment when Miraz trips on grass, right? So he's fighting and then he trips and he falls over. And Peter, instead of pressing his advantage, sort of steps back. Okay, steps back and gives him a chance to get back up. And Edmund says, oh, why did he do that? But he says, this is honorable conduct in battle. And he says, this is because Peter is both a knight and a high king. And it's just the sort of conduct that Aslan would like. He's going to fight fair. He's going to play by the rules. He's not going to do cheap shots. So he's honorable. He's a knight. He's got a code. So that's Peter in battle. He's wise. He's shrewd. He uses his strengths. He doesn't fall prey to the taunts. And then far more important than this, though, I think, and in many cases more directly applicable to us, to you, is not the warlike virtues, but is the chivalry that he shows outside of battle. Okay, so here's a number of things that Peter does. And this is part of the war. This is part of that ideal. It needs to be a package. So first, he shows real concern for the dignity of other people. Okay, so Peter shows concern for the dignity of other people. So if you remember in the story, early on, the four children are trying to figure out if they can swim across that channel. Like they're on the island and can we swim across it? And Peter said, it would be all right for Sue, said Peter, because Susan had won prizes for swimming, but I don't know about the rest of us. And then the narrator comments, by the rest of us, he really meant Edmund, who couldn't even do two laps, and Lucy, who couldn't hardly swim at all. But what do you notice about what he says? Okay, it'd be all right for Sue, but it wouldn't be all right for you guys, because you can't swim, idiots, right? He doesn't do that. He places himself with them. The rest of us would have a hard time. He identifies with his weaker siblings in order to allow them to maintain their dignity. Does that make sense? He's concerned for their dignity. He's not going to embarrass them. He avoids placing unnecessary blame on his two younger siblings. Later, there's a scene where he controls his own temper, and he has to manage conflict among the group. So at one point, Trumpkin kind of insults the kids, and he's like, hey, we wanted some warriors, and we got children. This is not great. And Edmund's kind of getting offended by it, and Peter says, hey, everybody cool it. There's no use losing our tempers, okay? And then later, Trumpkin sort of doubts that Lucy has seen Aslan, and she's about to come fight the dwarf. Like, she's like, I'm going to fight you because you said I didn't see Aslan. I saw Aslan, you idiot. Like, I'm coming after you. And Peter has to jump in the way and say, hey, Trumpkin doesn't get it. He doesn't get Aslan. He doesn't understand about the great lion. And then he turns to the dwarf and he's like, hey, knock it off. Right? He rebukes the dwarf. Stop doing that. So again, what he does is when he sees conflict coming, he leans in, not in order to stoke it, but in order to quell it. He's a peacemaker. Okay, so you have to think about it. He's a knight. He's a warrior. He could fight. He's stronger than all of his siblings and that dwarf. But instead of using his strength to crush other people, he maintains their dignity. And when they're going to fight, he inserts himself in order to bring order to quarrels, in order to bring order to fights. This is a chivalric moment. And then at one point, he gets lost. Okay, they're looking for this river. Peter is frustrated with his own leadership. He still maintains his temper, and then the narrator says, but it was with some difficulty. In other words, this wasn't easy. He wasn't just like, oh, he's a super placid, even-keeled guy all the time. No, he's getting frustrated, but when he feels that frustration rising, pulls it together, and he says, I've got to lead, Okay, my family needs me. The Narnians need me. We've got to go find them. I'm pulling it together, and I'm going to lead even through hardship. Okay, an explosive situation. The other thing, here's a third example of Peter's understanding it's his understanding of his role in the story. This is a really important one. He's the high king over all kings in Narnia. Like, he's the high king, okay? But he's coming back, and Caspian is the one who's supposed to get put on the throne. Okay, so how many of you have ever seen the movies? Okay. This is one of those places where the movies are stupid. Really, like bad. Like, it's the producers clearly did not understand what Lewis is doing. Because if you remember in the movies, what happens when Caspian meets Peter? They're always kind of sizing each other up, and it's like that kind of peacock thing, like who's the bigger man? And they're competing. There's a rivalry, like who's going to be the boss? Who's the big dog? Who's the alpha? And there's this competition. In the books, there's not a hint of that. Because Lewis is trying to show, like, Peter's not coming back and, like, preening, like, I'm the high king, you gotta best respect me. Instead, he's coming in, and the first thing he says to Caspian is this: I haven't come to take your place, but to put you into it. I'm not here to take your place. I'm not here to elbow you out. I'm not here to lord it over you. I'm here to put you into your proper place. I'm your servant, even though I'm the high king. Okay? And I think that the movie, the writers in the movie, the producers in the movie, they just have no categories for this. They're like, well, if there are two strong, dominant, knightly type young guys, of course they're going to fight with each other. Of course. And so they actually had the mindset, Miraz at one point says, when somebody tells him, Miraz about the four kings and queens, like back in the old days, there were these four kings and queens, the Pevensies. And he says, whoever heard of two kings at one time? That's impossible. And it's like, well, it's impossible if you're godless. It's impossible if you're sinful. But if you're humble, if you're godly, yeah, you can have two kings. You can have a high king and you can have his younger brother who doesn't compete with him, who doesn't bow up against him, but knows his place, knows his role. Peter knows his role. All right. Finally, Peter often knows how to show that sense of generosity, magnanimity, humility. And so when he sees the badger, truffle hunter's faithfulness, he kisses him on the head and honors him. He honors the bear's ancient right to serve as marshal of the list, even though the bear's going to embarrass everybody by sucking on his paws. He tries to cheer up the giant when the giant totally blows it in battle. And so he says, hey, this guy just totally blew it. He's crying his eyes out. All of the mice are wet because they sat underneath the giant and he got them all wet. He's super discouraged, but I want to try to encourage him by using him to intimidate the other side. I'll send him as one of the emissaries to do that. And then when Reepicheep wants to be the marshal of the list and they're like, hey, we actually don't want a mouse in that role. That's not that intimidating. He says, no, Reepicheep, some humans are afraid of mice. I've heard that, sire, right? So in other words, he's considering his dignity. He's not going to embarrass him in front of everybody. He's considering his dignity. And so all of these examples, okay, all of these sort of examples, if you read the stories, they're actually really small things. They're not big things. It's not the main action of the battle and the trees and all that kind of stuff. These are the small things. And that's the point. That's actually the point. The important thing is not just fighting bravely and winning the battle. The important things are the little things. Manners, right? Small kindnesses, small acts of generosity, they matter. That's love in the little things, love in the trifles, and they matter. That's part of this chivalric ideal. So that's one way. When you think about fighting like a Narnian, you ought to think about this for your own lives, okay? So how many of you have siblings? Okay, how much of your time with your siblings is competition? How much of it is you quarreling and fighting? How much, when you put the two of you together, or the three of you together, or the eight of you together, how much of it is like there's going to be a fight? There's going to be a quarrel. I'm looking to provoke and I'm looking to be provoked. Okay? If that's you, right, that's the thing that has to die. That's where the war is. The war is not against your sibling. It's against that thing in your heart that wants to provoke them or that is going to take offense over every little thing. And here's the deal about this. When I have kids. I've got a 14-year-old, 12-year-old, 4-year-old. And so I see the conflicts. I know that my boys are capable of being around other boys and showing kindness, generosity of spirit, friendship, glad-heartedness. They can do it because they have friends. Okay, but for some reason, when you put them around their sibling, all of a sudden it's like, right? That happens. And that's the thing that's said. So I know that every one of you, all of you have friends. And you're able to be kind to them. And you're able to encourage them. You don't have to compete with them. When they succeed, you're excited. You're thrilled, right? You cheer on your buddy, whatever. You're able to do that. And then all of a sudden, when it's your younger sister, it's like, man, why do good things happen to her? And now it's quarreling, okay? So you're capable of it, but you don't apply it across the board. That's what God wants you to do. That's the sin he wants you to fight. All right, that's number one. Couple more of these here. Trumpkin. Oh, man. About to press on some stuff here. You guys remember the story of Trumpkin. There's a really interesting, if you're thinking it like literally about how Trumpkin works in the story, you've got Trumpkin and then Truffle Hunter and Nickabrick. Remember these three friends? I assume you guys know these stories. Like I'm talking to you like some of you, everybody knows the stories. I'm not talking to people who are like, who is he talking about? Okay, I assume you know the stories. So in the story, those three characters are actually meant to be set next to one another and compared. How does Truffle Hunter act? How does Nickabrick act? How does Trumpkin act? Okay, and I'm not going to get into all of that. There's more of that in the book if you want to go follow up on that. But like from a literary perspective, comparing and contrasting how those three characters act is important. I'm going to focus on Trumpkin because you notice that he is not like Nickabrick in every way, and he's not like Truffle Hunter. Truffle Hunter is faithful. He believes all the old stories. He wants the old ways to come back. Trumpkin's like, yeah, I think all that stuff's nonsense. But he's not bloodthirsty, he's not evil, he's not cruel like Nickabrick. He's sort of this middle ground, okay? So he doesn't even think that the High King Peter exists. When they start talking about naiads and dryads and the peoples of the wood and of the rivers, he's like, that's a fairy tale. Aslan, right, is a myth. It's an old wives' tale. This isn't real. So he doesn't believe the old stories, okay? And so when they first bring up Aslan, he says, who believes in Aslan nowadays? Nobody believes in Aslan nowadays. You crazy. I'm going to do a little... Don't you think Nickabrick's probably Irish? He's probably Irish. When Nickabrick's like, hey, let's invite some hags and ogres to be a part of our army. Let's go get some of the werewolves and people like that to be a part of the army. Caspian's like, I don't think Aslan would like that. And then Trumpkin says, oh, Aslan. What matters much more is that you wouldn't have me. There's no way I'm going to be a part of an army with hags and ogres and wolves. So even after he meets the kids, like the magic works, he's still like, I don't know about this. I don't believe in Aslan. And so at one point he says this when Lucy's like, hey, Aslan's telling me to follow him, but none of the others can see him. Right? Remember that scene? Lucy can see Aslan. And he's like, come on. And then she's like, we got to go that way. And they're like, no, we don't see him. And they ask Trumpkin what he thinks. And he says, I have no use for magic lions, which are talking lions and don't talk, and friendly lions, though they don't do us any good, and whopping big lions, though nobody can see them. It's all bilge and beanstalks as far as I can see. Right? This is all nonsense. It's all nonsense. So he's not a believer. He doesn't even believe. But there's this crucial conversation that happens in chapter 7. So in chapter 7, Caspian and his counselors are trying to decide whether it's time to blow the horn. You remember this scene? Like, do we blow the horn or not? Is this like our greatest need? And so Trumpkin's attitude is totally dismissive. He thinks this is stupid. He's like, oh, as for me, said the red dwarf who'd been listening with complete indifference, your majesty knows that I think the horn and that bit of broken stone over there and your great King Peter and your lion Aslan are all eggs and moonshine. Okay? It's all one to me when your majesty blows the horn. All I insist on is that the army's told nothing about it. No good raising hopes of magical help, which is, I think, as sure as to be disappointed. So he's like, this is all nonsense, but fine, blow the horn if you want. And then they say, okay, well, if we're going to blow the horn, we're going to have to send messengers to these like magic spots to see if anybody shows up. And so now he's like, oh, great. This magical foolery is just going to lose our army to fighters. Now we're going to have less people available. And then he does the most remarkable thing in the story about him, okay? He volunteers to be one of the messengers. Send me, sire, I'll go. But I thought you didn't believe in the horn, Trumpkin, said Caspian. Oh, no more I do, your majesty. But what's that got to do with it? I might as well die in a wild goose chase as die here. You are my king. I know the difference between giving advice and taking orders. You've had my advice. Now it's time for the orders. This is amazing, okay? This is an amazing scene. This is the central lesson that Lewis is doing in Trumpkin, which is embracing obedience to lawful authority, even when you disagree with the orders or think they're stupid. Like, he doesn't believe this, okay? He doesn't believe in Aslan, but he actually is following in the ways of Aslan despite himself. His honor, his allegiance to his friend, his humility, his willingness to be taught, his loyalty, all of these lead to the moment when he finally sees Aslan for the first time and the lion welcomes him as a friend. Okay, so how does that work for you guys? How many of you have ever chafed or been frustrated by your parents' rules? Okay, the ones who don't have their hands up are lying. Okay, you're lying. Like, there are times when, whether it's your parents' entertainment standards, whether it's their clothing standards, why do I have to wear that? Right? Whether it's you need to get a haircut, why do I gotta get a haircut? You can't go out in public like that, right? Whatever the things are, there are times when your parents come to you and they say, this is the standard, this is the expectation, and you think it's dumb. You think, why do I have to do it? And you chafe and you, okay, so what does God expect of you in that moment? God expects Trumpkin-like cheerful obedience. He expects for you to go, I'm gonna obey anyway. Now, you can ask the questions. There's a place for giving advice. If you wanna give advice to your parents, that's fine. If you wanna humbly, respectfully say to them, hey, can you help me understand why I can't wear these clothes to that place, or why I have to cut my hair in this way, or why I can't go watch that movie, or why I can't go hang out with those people? Your parents ought to have all kinds of patience for those kinds of questions. But those kind of questions come when? After you obey. After you obey. Obey first, then ask the questions. And here's the deal. Obey cheerfully. Because all of you, the folks that are kind of come to a conference like this, I expect that most of you are pretty obedient kids. Okay? But the temptation for obedient people is to offer grumbling, begrudging obedience. I will do the right thing, but I will do it with a sufficient amount of growling. I will make sure everybody knows how unhappy I am to be doing this thing that I've been asked to do. Okay? That's not godly. God doesn't want your grumbling obedience. Your parents don't want your grumbling obedience. What kind of obedience do they want? Cheerful, glad-hearted, humble, respectful. Do that, then ask your questions. Then make your case. But Dad, here's five reasons why I think I should be able to wear this. Do it, that's fine, but do it humbly, respectfully, and cheerfully. God requires of us cheerful obedience with humility and respect. All right, last lesson. Ooh, I got two more, not enough time for both. I'm just gonna pick. I was gonna give you the choice, but what do you know? All right. Here's the thing. I was going to talk about King Loon. King Loon's my favorite character. First in, last out, laughing loudest. That comes from him because that's how we should go into war. So I'll just do it briefly. This is what it means to be a king, to be first in every desperate attack, to be last in every desperate retreat. And when there's hunger in the land, as must be now and again in bad years, to wear finer clothes and laugh louder at a scantier meal than any man in your land. That's King Loon's ideal of kingship. I think Lewis actually is in doing this. This is another little literary thing. If you guys are thinking about college, you want to come to NSA, hey, this is the sort of stuff we talk about here, is he's actually getting it from Henry V. If you've ever read the play Henry V by Shakespeare, Henry V actually has a similar, embodies that sort of kingship. And I think Lewis is drawing on Shakespeare in order to do this. So there's some really cool, I've written some stuff on this. It's super fun kind of literary background. If you like stories, if you like that sort of thing. So first in, okay, there's danger. What should you want to do? Be the first one in. Be the first one in, right? I'm going to take the hit first. I'm going to lead. I'm going to take an issue. That's how you fight. That's what it means to fight like a Christian. Last in every desperate retreat. Okay, so who's the one that's going to be staying late, picking up after everybody else? After everybody else has gone home, who's going to be staying up late? The leaders will, right? Because I'm going to be the last one out. I'm not going to be the first one to get to bed. I'm going to be the last one to get to bed. Okay, and what's my demeanor in doing it? Again, glad-heartedness. So if you think about that situation that he describes, when there's hunger in the land, okay, this is when things are not going well. This is when things are going wrong. This is when your expectations are not being met. So there's plenty of times in your life when you had expectations, when you had hopes. You thought that this is the thing you were going to do this weekend. We were going to get to go do the fun thing. And then it rained. And so you're not going to get to do the fun thing. Okay? What is that moment? There's a moment, every one of you experienced it. There's a moment when the hard thing happens, your expectations are now shot, you're not gonna get to do the thing you wanted, okay? That moment is the moment of testing. Will you laugh louder at a scantier meal? Will you make the best of it? Will you look at, this is especially true for you if your older siblings and your younger siblings are gonna be in this situation, okay? I think about this a lot as a dad with my kids, okay? We all have plans, we think something's gonna happen, and then it doesn't happen, we're disappointed. My job, the fundamental call God has for me in that moment is to laugh louder at the scantier meal, to make the most of it. If you guys know the saying, right? If life throws you a lemon, what do? No, you pick the lemon, throw it back, and hit life where it hurts. No, you make lemonade, right? You take it and you make the best of it. You laugh louder at a scantier meal. That's the kind of sacrificial, glad-hearted attitude that God expects of his people when they fight. All right, that was the brief version. Here's the last one. How many of you, when you first read the stories, or even now, I have this thing now, how many of you have ever had that kind of thought, like that wish, like what if it was real? You know what I'm talking about? Like, what if Narnia was actually a real thing, a real place that you could get to? Like, wouldn't it be cool if? That kind of thing? You know what I'm talking about, that feeling? Okay, so most of us who read, when you read the book as children, you developed a secret wish somehow, like you don't have wardrobes, but if you ever came across one, you'd probably check just to be sure, right? You're like, I don't think it is, but maybe, right? So you would open just to check. Okay. Wouldn't it be amazing if we could get into Narnia? Wouldn't it be amazing? And that could be true of Narnia, or it could be true if you've got another favorite story, if you love Lord of the Rings, or if you love some other fictional story, you're like, wouldn't it be cool if, okay? That feeling, that hope, I want to connect to something about your life right now as a teenager, okay? So I assume you guys are all 14 to 18, 19, I don't know how, somewhere in that range, which means you're at a particular season of your life, and that season of life is one in which you are typically looking forward to the next season of your life, right? So this is the time in your life when you're like, I cannot wait to, and for some of you, it's like, be able to drive. I can't wait to be able to drive. For some of you, it's you already have the keys, and you're like, I can't wait to graduate. I can't wait to get out of my hometown. I can't wait to go to college. I can't wait to get into adulthood. I can't wait. You know what I'm talking about? That feeling? Like, won't it, so here's the connection. Won't it be great when? That feeling. Do you know what I'm talking about? Okay, I want you to think about that. Okay? Won't it be amazing when I've graduated and launched into life? Won't it be great when I can have wheels and I can get wherever I want to go? And that's a good feeling. It's good and right for you to feel that way. That opportunities that you're going to have that are before you are amazing, you're entering adulthood, all of the independence possibilities, that's great. So that season is like standing at the threshold of the wardrobe and seeing that lamppost up ahead and going, this is about to get good. Okay, so that's the thing. Now, here's the thing that Lewis does with that feeling. It totally crushes it. No. One of the key lessons he teaches is the connection between your character on this side of the wardrobe and what happens to you when you get in. Okay, so this is Edmund. So we're thinking about Edmund here. And I know you're like, what does this have to do with fighting? It's about fighting the sin in your own life right here. When you first meet Edmund in the very first story, what is he like? Would you want to be friends with him? You would not. Okay? He had no friends. He had no friends. Okay? Why? Because he's bad-tempered. He always picking at his siblings. When Susan says, hey, it's time for us to go to bed, who are you to say when I'm supposed to go to bed? You go to bed yourself. Right? Not the way you're supposed to talk to a sibling. When Lucy comes back from Narnia and is like, hey, I got into the secret country, we're told Edmund could be spiteful. And he sneers and he jeers at her and he mocks her. And then when he sees her later, he sees her entering the wardrobe, he follows her. Why does he follow her? Because he wants to get into the wardrobe too and go to Narnia? No, because he wanted to go on teasing her about her imaginary country. So he's looking for opportunities to provoke. Does that make sense? That's the kind of kid he is. Then he gets into Narnia, realizes Lucy is right, and so he apologizes this way. He says, sorry, Lou. She's not around. And when she doesn't respond, Edmund says, oh, that's just like a girl sulking somewhere and won't accept an apology. And it's like, well, when you offer it so sincerely, how could that? But when he finally meets her, he provides a perfect example of how not to apologize. He comes up to her and he says, all right, I see you were right. It is a magic wardrobe after all. I'll say I'm sorry if you like. I'll say I'm sorry if you like. Like, what kind of sincerity? Is that how your parents never taught you to apologize like that? That's not godly, right? So he's not apologetic. He's not humble. He's not driven by genuine remorse. He just wants to kind of check the box. So he only seeks forgiveness reluctantly. Then later, after the two get back from Narnia, Lucy's super stoked because, hey, now they're gonna believe her because Edmund saw it too. But then Edmund does, it says this, and now we come to one of the nastiest things in this story. Think about that. One of the nastiest, this is a story that has a white witch who has literally enslaved Narnia for like 100 years and makes it to where it's always winter and never Christmas. And Lewis is like, yeah, but the nasty thing is what Edmund did next. Up to that moment, Edmund had been feeling sick and sulky and annoyed with Lucy for being right. Don't you hate that when your siblings are right? But he hadn't made up his mind what to do when Peter suddenly asked him the question, what about it, Ed? Did you get into this country? He decided all at once to do the meanest and most spiteful thing he could think of. He decided to let Lucy down. And she was like, what? No, we were just play acting. I was just pretending. Putting on a very superior look, he tells Peter and Susan he and Lucy were just playing and pretending there was a country in the wardrobe. Lucy runs away crying, and Edmund gets Peter's anger, and he says, you've always been beastly to anyone smaller than yourself. We've seen that at school before now. And then we're later told that Edmund had started going wrong at the school he was at. So this is the type of person he is on this side of the wardrobe. Spiteful, disrespectful, beastly, insincere in his apologies, and cruel. That's the kind of thing. So here's the question. He's all excited. He's going to get into Narnia. What happens when a kid like that goes to Narnia? And you remember what happens. Who's the first person he meets? White witch, right? That's intentional, right? That's providence guiding him in judgment, right? The author put him in that situation in order to bring judgment upon him. He meets the white witch. He eats her enchanted food. He goes over to her side. Whenever they finally figure out that he lied to them and Peter rebukes him, he's like, I'm going to pay you out for this, you pack of stuck-up, self-satisfied prigs. Like, he just doubles down on his sin, hardening of heart, deep bitterness. And then, of course, you remember what was his reaction when he first heard the name of Aslan, right? So you remember they're sitting in the beaver's house. Beaver leans in and is like, Aslan is on the move. And Peter all of a sudden feels brave and courageous. Susan feels like this delicious smell just wafted by. Lucy feels like the holidays, it's summer break, right? That great feeling of like waking up and like, it's summer, okay? Edmund has a feeling of mysterious horror. Right? He hears Aslan's name and he's like, ugh. He leaves his family, goes over to the White Witch, tricks himself into thinking that she's going to make him king, and then he ends up whipped, tied to a tree with a witch's knife at his throat. And the only thing that saves him is the grace of God, right? And Aslan's kindness. What's the point of that? Why am I bringing that up? Why are we landing the plane here? Here's the point. We are always becoming who we will be. Or put it this way, you are always sowing the seeds of your future self. You are always sowing the seeds of your future self. And so when you stand on the threshold and you're looking forward to, won't it be great when? Won't it be great when I'm grown, when I'm an adult, when I have independence? Won't it be great when? And it's like, it might be great. It could be amazing if you're humble, godly, obedient, and you trust in the Lord. If you don't, if you're a punk, if you're a grumbler, if you're a complainer, then I guarantee you, it will not be great when you get in. You'll follow the Edmund path, right? You'll double down on the sin. So the decisions you make today will shape the person you are tomorrow, because right now you are headed somewhere and eventually you'll get there. And if you're headed toward hardness of heart and bitterness and unbelief, you will eventually arrive. The Bible talks this way. This is my last thing. I'm going to quote Lewis and then I'll quote the Bible. Here's what Lewis put it. Every time you make a choice, you are turning the central part of you, the heart. You're turning that central part of you, the part of you that chooses, into something a little different than it was before. And taking your life as a whole, with all of your choices, all your life long, you are slowly turning that central thing either into a heavenly creature or into a hellish creature. That is, a creature that's in harmony with God and with other creatures and with itself, or one that's in a state of war. Fight like a Narnian, and hatred with God and with fellow creatures and with itself. And so to be the one kind of creature is heaven, to be the other kind of creature is horror, idiocy, rage, and loneliness. each of us at each moment is progressing to the one state or the other. You're going somewhere and you will eventually arrive. So where are you compromising, right? That's the question you should ask. Where are you nursing small grievances, you know, frustrations against your parents, your friends, your siblings, the kind that grow and fester into hatred? Do you treat other people with respect and kindness, or are you always trying to show off your own superiority? When you wrong someone, do you repent like Edmund does, or do you repent thoroughly and you seek forgiveness sincerely and you make it right? Given the present trajectory of your life, what would happen if you stumbled into the wardrobe? Would you meet a fawn who becomes a friend, or would you meet the witch who's going to steal, kill, and destroy? And what would be your reaction if you heard Aslan's name for the first time? Here's the way the Bible puts it. Do not be deceived. This is Galatians chapter 6. God is not mocked. Whatever one sows, that will he also reap. The one who sows to his own flesh will from the flesh reap corruption. The one who sows to the Spirit will from the Spirit reap eternal life. Let us not grow weary of doing good, for in due season we will reap if we do not give up. This time in your life as a teenager is a major time of sowing. You are sowing seeds right now, right now. And so the question is, what kind of seeds are you going to sow? That's the kind of harvest you will get. We're all tempted to believe that we can sow seeds of sin and reap a harvest of blessing. We can sow envy, we can sow strife, worldliness, laziness, lust, pride, and then we can have a harvest of joy and life and fruitfulness. God's not mocked. So take care how you sow, because don't give up. You have need of endurance. The path of faith in Christ, obedience to God, cheerful obedience to God, love for others is not an easy one. But Jesus is real. He is with you and he's for you. Seek him and fight like an Arnian.
If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to watch the videos from the full Grace Agenda 2023 conference now on Canon Plus.